The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Hi. How you doing? Great. My name is Jamie Bowers, and I'm the program director of the 215 Festival, which is Philadelphia's annual celebration of the literary arts. And tonight is the kickoff event. Whether you knew it or not, you're here at the kickoff event. And all this weekend, we have lots of really exciting events that are mostly free, all celebrating books and writing and everything that literature can be. So immediately after tonight's event at the International House in West Philly, we'll show some short experimental films all about the literary form. And following that will be a rare screening of Pull My Daisy, which was narrated by Jack Kerouac, was scored by David Amram, and stars Allen Ginsberg and Alice Neal. So that's a really nice rare screening. So that should go on sometime around 9:30, 9:45 tonight. You should be able to make it. But Friday night, we've got an event all about the first graffiti artist who's from Philadelphia, Cornbread. Saturday is a festival within a festival, really. It's Lovingly Bound, the Book and Arts Fair, which brings together small publishers, book artists, and Latvian beer and food and performances. And Sunday, the festival culminates with an amateur spelling bee, so you could test your tongue and win a prize if you dare. This is the program. It looks like this, and the program's on the back, and it's outside of the door. So pick one up before you go. So I'd like to welcome tonight the person who's going to introduce this wonderful program, John Leland.
Thanks. Wow, lots of people here tonight. Thank you for coming. So we're going to obsess about Kerouac a little bit tonight, and by that I want to say, you know, welcome to my world for the last year and a half or so. I'm here because I've just written a book called Why Kerouac Matters, and it's about a little bit about my obsession with Kerouac and with On the Road. We will have a little music tonight, and we'll have some readings, and then we will have a conversation among ourselves, and then hopefully you guys will have some questions, and we'll turn it over to questions from the audience. So we're here now because it's 50 years since On the Road came out on September 5th, 1957, half a century. And it's a funny book. It's a book that Kerouac never thought very much of. He was never satisfied with it. And almost as soon as he finished it, he started rewriting it in a different book that he also called On the Road, which was not published until after his death. And when he finished writing that, he told friends that he was now started on another On the Road, a 1,000-page epic, that nothing ever came of that. And it's a book that was kind of born in mythology, you know, that central myth we have of Kerouac sitting down in April of 1951 at his typewriter and in 3 weeks banging this out off the top of his head with or without the help of amphetamines, which over the course of years we've turned out isn't quite true, that he had written a lot of this stuff in his journals and his letters over the years, and it had incorporated bits of that in the text, and that he had written several drafts of On the Road before he got to that. It's a book that's been misunderstood, both by the people who love it and embrace it as a call to go wild and crazy, and the people who have thought of it as a threat to our children. Kerouac said two things about it that stood out for me, and one is in his journals just before he had written the book. He said, it's a powerful and singularly gloomy book, but good. And the other thing he said was that after it had come out and after it had been a success, someone had asked him about the book, and he'd said, well, it's about two Catholic buddies who go out in search of God, and we found him. So that's very different from the things that we think about with On the Road. And another thing about it was a woman in the L.A. Times recently wrote that it's about trying to get out of New Jersey and failing. So that's another on the road. The nice thing about it being 50 years from now is that we can sort of peel away some of the myths about the book and look at it more honestly. And that's what I've tried to do for the last year, and I try to do in my book. And it's what we will do in our panel tonight. Now, one of the things that's been helpful is that Viking recently published that original scroll draft, that three-week publication. And we're fortunate enough to have one of the editors of that, Penny Vlagopoulos, who helped put that together. She's here tonight. We also have David Amram, the great musician who was a collaborator with Kerouac, author of the memoir Offbeat, Collaborations with Kerouac, and the upcoming memoir, and I love this title, Upbeat, The Nine Lives of a Musical Cat. And rounding this out is Joyce Johnson, and before I met Joyce, I said that her book, Minor Characters, was the best written book that had Kerouac in it, and I will still maintain that. Joyce was Kerouac's girlfriend when On the Road came out, and she provided the bus fare for him to get up to New York from Orlando for the event, and for which we owe her many thanks. And she wrote about this in Minor Character, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award. And she's also the author of other novels and memoirs, the most recent of which is Missing Men. Now, they will come up now, and David will play some music, and Joyce and Penny will do some readings, and then we will kick it off, if you please. And a round of applause for them.
Just want to thank all of you for coming. Since I was born in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, USA, brought up in Feasterville on Busselton Pike, right next to the Summer and Spring swimming pool, when that was all farms. Some of your grandparents might remember that time. It's a special joy to be back here in Philadelphia to honor Jack Kerouac. 1956, I met him at a bring-your-own-bottle party and started playing music with him spontaneously. We had such a good time. On the Road hadn't come out. We were both stupendously unknown and loved what we were doing. And before I play one piece and then invite our two wonderful scholars who are going to read, as I did with Jack at the first ever jazz poetry readings 50 years ago in New York City, some of those same passages, I'd like to read one paragraph written by Jack Kerouac himself to dispel the horrors of Dobie Gillis's stereotypical version of what
the Beat Generation
and the word
beat,
and the word of all words,
beatnik,
is supposed to mean, in order to discourage people from reading the books, judging Jack as an artist, as a writer, as a man of letters, and as a beautiful, inspirational person who now has made a whole new generation energized to do something creative themselves. That's what it's all about, whether it's Dostoevsky or Kerouac. A great artist, a writer of any kind, encourages other people to feel alive, to delve into themselves and to do something beautiful and share it with others. And this is what Jack said when he was interviewed by an enraged, soured critic who was accusing him of being beat and wanting to know what all that stuff was about. Jack said, "No, I want to speak four things. For the crucifix I speak out. For the Star of Israel I speak out. For the divinest man who ever lived, who was a German, Bach, I speak out. For sweet Muhammad I speak out. For Buddha, I speak out. For Lao Tse and Chuang Tse, I speak out. For D.T. Suzuki, I speak out. Why should I attack what I love out of life? Live your lives out? Nah. Love your lives out." That's what Jack Kerouac said. And we also want to thank John Leland for being here and writing a wonderful new book with a new picture of what Kerouac means today without all the beat stuff, but what it is in terms of his role as an author and as a person who has helped to change society in a way that we're beginning to understand. In my remaining 28 minutes, I'm going to play one little piece as a welcoming song. It's a Ladies' Choice Round Dance. I couldn't think of anything more appropriate to introduce these two great women scholars, writers, and authors than to do a two-minute piece. It's an American Indian piece that I learned from Floyd Red Crow Westerman, and by an amazing serendipity, it's the main theme of a piece that I wrote for the Philadelphia Orchestra, which I'm sure you've all heard of, which Eugene Ormandy conducted. And when I was commissioned to write the piece for the Rittenhouse Square Women's Committee, Ormandy said, "Whatever you do, no jazz!" Because he did not have the sensibility that folkloric music, not realizing that Dvorak, Tchaikovsky, Bach, Mozart, Brahms, and Bartok used, as Jack Kerouac did, what surrounded them, the beauty that surrounded them, for their inspiration as a basis for formal work, combining the spontaneous and the formal. I used this traditional piece. I said, "No, maestro, this is an American Indian piece." And he said, "It all sounds the same." And I said, "No, maestro, it does on television in the beer commercial, but the hoo-ya-da-da, hoo-ya-da-da is not what the American Indians themselves play." So I want to play this beautiful old song. It's a Lady's Choice Round Dance. And this was something that ended up being the basis for something that I wrote for the Philadelphia Orchestra. Jack Kerouac was very, very interested in Native American culture and Native Canadian culture years, decades before that became something that was de rigueur or fashionable, before the word multiculturalism existed. And the sensibility of combining the spontaneous, the everyday, with the formal was what he was about and what I'm about as a composer, and so many of the artists then were about, and many are today. So this is a piece called Bastinchalo Wachipe, and I'm going to be accompanied by a wonderful young man and my son, Adam Amram. Thank you, thank you. Thank you. So, as a welcoming song, Ladies Round Dance, we want to welcome a wonderful young scholar. She's getting her PhD at Columbia. She's a terrific reader. She inspires younger people to study hard, to excel, to outdo themselves, and is the embodiment of the work ethic. And with all the books Jack Kerouac wrote, so was he. Reading in one beautiful paragraph, the whole history of jazz, children of the American bop night, Penny Vlagopoulou.
Hi. Once there was Louis Armstrong, blowing his beautiful top in the muds of New Orleans. Before him, the mad musicians who had paraded on official days and broke up the salsa marches into ragtime. Then there was swing and Roy Eldridge, vigorous and virile, blasting the horn for everything it had in waves of power and logic and subtlety. Leaning to it with glittering eyes and a lovely smile, and sending it out broadcast to rock the jazz world. Then had come Charlie Parker, a kid in his mother's woodshed in Kansas City, blowing his taped-up alto among the logs, practicing on rainy days, coming out to watch the old swinging Basie and Benny Moten band that had Hot Lips Page and the rest. Charlie Parker leaving home and coming to Harlem and meeting Mad Thelonious Monk and Matter Gillespie. Charlie Parker in his early days when he was flipped and walked around in a circle while playing. Somewhat younger than Lester Young, also from KC, that gloomy, saintly goof in whom the history of jazz was wrapped. For when he held his horn high and horizontal from his mouth, he blew the greatest. And as his hair grew longer and he got lazier and stretched out, his horn came down halfway till it finally fell all the way. And today, as he wears his thick-soled shoes so that he can't feel the sidewalks of life, his horn is held weakly against his chest and he blows cool and easy get-out phrases. Here were the children of the American bop night. Thank you.
Yeah. And in our crash course, 28-minute Mr. Rogers gets down with the history of the last 50 years, we would like to move right on and have one of the most wonderful writers. She won the National Book Award for that great book that she wrote called Minor Characters. And she's written many, many other books, Door Wide Open. The letters between Joyce Johnson and Jack Kerouac are priceless. It was made into a wonderful play, which I had the honor of working on for 3 years in performance. That's just terrific. And many, many other books. Her association with Jack Kerouac is just one fraction of her tremendous abilities as a writer of distinction herself. And it's such a joy she could be here tonight, all these years later, just as young and vital and beautiful and wonderful and talented as when we met, actually, I guess 50 years ago. It seems incredible. Joyce Johnson.
At night, in this part of the West, the stars, as I had seen them in Wyoming, are big as Roman candles and as lonely as the prince of the Dharma, who's lost his ancestral grove and journeys across the spaces between points in the handle of the Big Dipper, trying to find it again. So they slowly wheel the night, and then long before actual sunrise, the great red light appeared far over the dun bleak land, toward West Kansas, and the birds took up their trill above Denver. I wondered what the spirit of the mountain was thinking, and looked up and saw jack pines in the moon, and saw ghosts of old miners, and wondered about it. In the whole eastern dark wall of the divide this night, there was silence and the whisper of the wind. Except in the ravine where we roared, and on the other side of the divide was the great western slope and the big plateau that went to Steamboat Springs and dropped and led you to the eastern Colorado desert and the Utah desert. All in darkness now, as we fumed and screamed in our mountain nook. We were on the roof of America, and all we could do was yell, I guess, across the night, eastward over the plains, where somewhere an old man with white hair was probably walking toward us with the word and would arrive any minute. and make us silent.
And also, I'd like to make a request at the very end of On the Road and in the Scrolls, one of the most beautiful things ever written in the English language. A Penny has a copy of it there, of the finale of the end of On the Road. This is the one that Jack read on the Steve Allen show, which fortunately was preserved. And next to Jack, no one can read it better than Joyce Johnson.
So in America, when the sun goes down and I sit on the old broken-down river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey and sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the West Coast and all that road going, all the people dreaming in the immensity of it. And in Iowa, I know by now, the children must be crying in the land where they let the children cry. And tonight the stars will be out. And don't you know that God is Pooh Bear? The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in. And nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. I think of Dean Moriarty. I even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. I think of Dean Moriarty.
Well, in my remaining 12 minutes, because both Dizzy Gillespie and many others I know who are considered to be from that era were very fastidious about not going 1 second over the allotted time. So I would like to do one piece. Since there's going to be a showing of the film Pull My Daisy, which some of you might have seen, it was actually kind of a home movie that we made in 1959 to show our eventually children or grandchildren. We weren't a bunch of unregenerate, self-loathing, untalented, stoned out sociopathic morons, which we were instructed that we were supposed to behave like, or we were supposed to be, when we found out that we were some kind of quasi charter members of the Beat Generation. But rather, something that we wanted to document to show that we were a whole bunch of friends. And when you see the movie, you'll notice that none of us look like beatniks or beat people. The only thing we had in common was all of us were so different from one another. And when they decided to make this little film, which you'll see, they wrote a little title song, or wanted to write a title song, that kind of a group poem that Neil Cassidy, Jack Kerouac, and Allen Ginsberg would write in a great big book. The way when you're going on a summer vacation, everybody makes up rhymes not to go crazy. They would kind of just make it a group thing that was a huge, long poem. So Jack chose the verses he thought would be the most appropriate. And we're going to do that version as the title song, and then we're going to have the panel discussion. And this starts off with what young folks today call freestyling. We called it scatting. And when Homer did the Iliad and the Odyssey, since he couldn't see and had no career counselor or cue cards to tell him what to do, he rapped it out and someone else wrote it down. This is scarcely an original procedure. And we're delighted to play it for you. And then afterwards, when we're signing the books, if anybody wants to have any discussions about free-form writing or metal problems, I'll be glad to answer your questions. Well, in the remaining 7.5 minutes that we have this evening, I want to share something with all of you. Because being back in Philadelphia again after all these years is a joy that will never be through. And tomorrow when I go with Adam and Penny to Lowell, Massachusetts, which is Jack's hometown, I'm going to tell everyone there about what we went tonight in Philadelphia and what was going down. Because you can really feel it when you read the book of John Leland and see what he had to say about Jack Kerouac. Because his own approach was individual and unique, and it really makes you not really want to go back. But to live in the now that Jack talked about, because Charlie Parker's Now is the Time was the anthem for all of us. And when you read Jack's books, you'll feel so much better that you could all join yourself on Jack's bus. not the bus of Ken Kesey, which is a different thing entirely, but the bus of the imagination and the soul, which means that every single person on earth has something creative to do and can make you feel real whole. Now, people who rhyme compulsively like this are taken out to Bustleton Pike where I was ordered for being certifiably crazy. So before they drag me away, I'll say that's the Philadelphia special introduction tonight for Pull My Daisy. I pull my daisy, tip my cup, all my doors are open, hop my heart for coconuts, all my eggs are broken, hop my heart song, harp my light, serves hold me steady, hip my angel, harp my light, lay it on the needy, hop my heart song, harp my light, serves hold me steady, hip my angel, harp my light, lay it on the needy. Well, when Jack and Neil and Alan and I wrote the song way back in 1959, never thought we'd be here 50 years later almost in Philadelphia feeling so fine. So for all of you who came tonight to look at Jack, we hope that you'll never think that you lack the creative ability to do something yourself and let other people's negative opinions remain on the shelf. Just follow your heart each and every day, and you'll find your own special way. If you don't believe it, you can reprieve it and deceive it. Now we're going to hear the senior bopper piano player play. Daisy, tip my cup, all my doors are open, hop my heart for coconuts, all my eggs are broken, hop my heart song, harp my light, serves hold you steady, hip my angel, harp my light, lay it on the needy, hop my heart song, harp my light, serves hold you steady, hip my angel, harp my light, lay, yeah, 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 that's the way folks used to scat sing on Broad Street here in Philadelphia way back 1942. When Billy Kretschmer was playing the clarinet, and he was the best bet if you wanted to hear jazz way back at that time, but Billy Root was playing on the saxophone. And Dizzy Gillespie moved to Philadelphia for a while before John Coltrane came, but he didn't feel alone. And at the same time, Jack left Lowell, Massachusetts, and went to a fine preparatory school. Because his father told him if he didn't get into a top five college, he would just remain working in a factory in Lowell, Massachusetts, to be an undereducated fool. Well, he fortunately was a great football player. He got into Columbia, but broke his leg. And since he and Lou Little were both proud people, neither of them could apologize or want to beg. So he left, and after no inspection and much rejection, his books finally came out at last. And he made friends with the great William F. Buckley, whose family came from Texas, and his father said he would never get into the nexus of the Eastern Seaboard establishment scene. Yeah, but he didn't get a random Texas accent. You know what I mean. So old William F. still affected a great English accent like some bad actor who flunked out of the Old Vic School of Bad Acting each and every day. Where Jack remained and retained himself and went his own special, individual, honest, soulful way. And now, fortunately, since Orville Prescott was on vacation, the third stringer, Gilbert Milstein, God bless his soul, came and gave the book a fantastically good review. And even though Orville hated it when he finally came back from vacation, the Sunday Times, it was too late, because by that time, everyone knew what to do, which was to read the book and enjoy each and every page rather than getting in some kind of a post-literary rage. And now, all these years later, Jack's books are more popular than ever because they stood the test of time, which means that if you follow your heart and do what's in your soul, it's a virtue, not a crime. So here with all these brilliant scholars, I'm going to say no more and open up the door to introduce them so we can have a panel discussion with all of you. And just one more thought before I'm through. Whether you want to write, paint, play, sing, or do anything creative, or have your children or grandchildren do the same thing before the year's coming 2008 spring, in the interest of spontaneity, let's all pull our daisy. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Oh, if I could, can I just say one tiny thing? I just wanted to say one thing for those of you who might be here from the Philadelphia Orchestra, my old friends. Because I'm doing this doesn't mean I'm retired from classical music. The world premiere of my symphony, Symphonic Variations on a Song by Woody Guthrie, was just premiered last Saturday, and I'm writing a piano concerto for them. And if you have fun and you do something spontaneous, it doesn't mean you can't be a serious person. Vice versa, you can be a serious person and also do things spontaneously. The formal and the informal balance the whole. And that's so much of what Jack's Gestalt was about and what we've tried to do. And that's an honor to be here with two scholars and a wonderful author to share some of Jack's philosophy with you. So, John, please continue.
Thank you, David. Come join us at the table. All right. I know we're in a library, and I know that the Phillies have contributed to the Philadelphia doldrums. But come on, a little more applause than that. We had the guy. He broke it down, and he ended on time. So a big round of applause. That's better. Now, it is great to hear this stuff read aloud, because that is so much the essence of Kerouac. He grew up in a French-Canadian immigrant home. They spoke Joual, the Joual dialect. In the home, he came to English as a second language. It was an oral language. You know, he was fascinated with the crazy, weird, delightful sounds of English, and I think he never lost that. So when we hear Penny and Joyce read it, we can hear things in it that are often maybe a little bit harder to get when we just read it in print. And it's part of what Kerouac was going for, I think, in his speed writing, is to try to capture those the cadences of speech and the essence of the oral language rather than the overworked on literary language. And there's some misconceptions, I think, about the spontaneous prose ethic, but it was something that he was developing as he went along, and something that was such a vital part, particularly of his later manuscripts, but even some of it is there in On the Road. And, you know, I mentioned before we have that central myth of Kerouac spending those 3 weeks and banging out that 120-foot taped-together scroll of tracing paper, that first draft of the book. And the myth was that he did it on Benzedrine, and Kerouac said it was nothing stronger than coffee, and that's what he recommended to his friends when they wanted to write like that. But, you know, I wanted to start the conversation with Penny, who was one of the editors of this scroll, which is out, and it's not terribly dissimilar from the book that we read, but has some points which are quite different. And I wanted to ask why it is, and it's published not for Kerouac scholars, but really for general readers, and why it is we care about this first draft. I mean, every book has a first draft. Kerouac complained about the editing of the book, but every writer under the sun has complained about their editors at some point, and perhaps even some of the writers who wrote for great editors like Joyce Johnson. So why should we care about this scroll draft? I mean, this, the book that we, as we read it, it's lasted 50 years, still sells 100,000 copies a year, more than anyone could have ever hoped for from it. So,
well, I'd be interested to hear what the audience thinks later, maybe if any of you have actually read it, just to see your impressions. But I think there are a number of different reasons why, for me anyway, the scroll is really important. On the first, most basic level, it's much more explicit in terms of its language. It's more sexually frank. So on one level, you have the book that Kerouac would have written if he wasn't a victim of the censorship of his period. And you get a better sense of what that social climate was like when you think of the editing that happened, so that you wouldn't have this use of language and these, you know, lots of just frank sexual acts, for example. On another level, there's some really beautiful passages in the scroll that you don't have in the 1957 text, and I actually just want to read one to you so you get a sense of how different, actually, the book is. In part one, there's a section where Sal and Dean, and this is the 1957 version, they go to Virginia and they find Sal's aunt, and then Kerouac writes, "My aunt once said the world would never find peace until men fell at their women's feet and asked for forgiveness." And it ends there. In the scroll version, the passage is, "My mother," because of course mother was changed to aunt, "My mother once said the world would never find peace until men fell at their women's feet and asked for forgiveness. This is true. All over the world, in the jungles of Mexico, in back streets of Shanghai, in New York cocktail bars, husbands are getting drunk while the women stay home with the babies of the ever-darkening future. If these men stop the machine and come home and get on their knees and ask for forgiveness and the women bless them, peace will suddenly descend on the earth with a great silence like the inherent silence of the apocalypse." And I just think that's a really interesting passage because Kerouac is often accused of being sexist. And in fact, you know, and On the Road, women are either, the men are running away from them or they're conduits. They're not usually on the road. But I think just with passages like that, you see that it's much more complex than that. And Kerouac's view of people was actually much more complex. So on that level, too, I think it's important to read the scroll. But for me, the really important difference is just the feeling of it. And that's also why I think, you know, we started the program with David tonight. Just the feeling of, for example, the jazz idiom, you really feel that with the scroll version a lot more. It's much more formally experimental. It's much closer, I think, to what Kerouac intended in terms of the style. And he's so often reduced to this sociological figure, and I feel like it's you really get the sense of what he was trying to do as a writer. The speed, you know, it's all one paragraph. Even the syntax and the grammar, it's so much more experimental. And if you look at it closely, it's a very different reading experience. And because so many readers only read On the Road and haven't read other Kerouac books, all of these differences to me are absolutely essential in figuring out what Kerouac was trying to do. So when you see the scroll version, I think you see all of these different things, and it changes a lot of people's views of what Kerouac was doing, and really brings to the forefront his project as a writer. I mean, he loved writing. He was a really disciplined writer. There was a great piece in The New Yorker, actually, last week. I don't know if anyone read it, by Louis Menand, about On the Road. And one thing that he writes in there is that the scroll is actually a mark of just how disciplined a writer Kerouac was. It's actually, instead of just this idea that he went crazy and just typed whatever came to his mind, it actually really shows the structure and the discipline that goes into the act of writing. And I think with the scroll version, that really comes out. But like I said, later, I'd be really interested to hear what any of you might think if you've read that version and if it makes much of a difference to you.
There was a couple things, you know, you mentioned how careful a writer he was, and there was a couple things that struck me, you know, going back and spending a lot of time with this book, and just, you know, one of the things we don't have the leisure time to read often in quite the way we'd like to. We browse a lot and we graze, but don't get to read, and I thought it was a great luxury to spend some time just reading this book. And on his first trip out, you know, the Sal Paradise character, who's the narrator, is a complete failure at the start. And he goes out and he says, he's very romantic, and he says, I was going to take Route 6 all the way across the country, and he gets to the start of his trip, and there's no cars on Route 6. So it's pouring rain, and someone takes pity on him and drives him to the bus station and says, you got to take the bus to Pittsburgh. And that had made no sense to me until, you know, later on when he's coming back from that trip, he's in Pennsylvania, he's just come through Pittsburgh, and he meets this character called The Ghost of the Susquehanna, who is a sort of a different version of himself, where he's got these myths about where he's traveling and where he's going to, and he has no idea where he's gone, but now he's like an old hobo and he's wandering around. And I thought that that reference to Pittsburgh was the key you, that Sal at the beginning was the same character as The Ghost of the Susquehanna, or that Ghost of the Susquehanna was a later vision of the early Sal character. And there's other things like that that just make it a book that's more fun to spend a lot of time with than we might think going into it. And I also loved it that you said that it was more explicit. I had a friend who had read The Naked and the Dead as a teenager, and he said, yeah, people used to go around saying frig all the time. So, Joyce, Kerouac was never thrilled with this book. I mean, he was a guy who could take things and walk away from them. He walked away from Columbia, walked away from his first marriage after a couple of weeks, walked away from the Navy, the Merchant Marine. This is a book he started writing in 47, started, stopped it, kept with it, was, you know, writing different versions of it, wrote the draft we know in 51, then kept rewriting it after that. What was he looking for in this, and why was he never satisfied with this?
Well, those years when he was writing those different drafts, one of them, I understand, was going to be about two brothers who are the sons of a very, very wealthy rancher who made a fortune out west. And they're actually half-brothers. They have the same mother. They're in love with the same girl. They go hitchhiking out to California together, where Jack said, there is nothing, and come back. That was one of the early drafts, quite different. You can see how it evolved. It took him a long time before he decided to write very directly about Neil Cassady, who had inspired the idea of the road books, and about himself on the road with Neil. He was looking for a voice. He began to develop this voice in the letters that he wrote Neil Cassady about writing. Neil Cassady had ambitions to become a writer too, and Jack thought he was a real natural talent, but he didn't have Jack's gift for language, or Jack's work habits, Jack finally decided he didn't want to write fiction anymore. He wrote to Neil, I want to renounce fiction and fear. And finally, in April of 1950, 51. He sat down and he wrote On the Road in 3 weeks. But it was the reason that he was able to do that, that sort of remarkable feat, was that, first of all, he had something that very few writers have. He had one of the most prodigious memories you could ever imagine. Just an incredible recall for, you know, word by word conversations he'd had with people years ago. It was truly amazing. He had all those versions of other On the Roads that he'd written with scenes and episodes that he was able to incorporate in this new book called On the Road. He had journal entries, notebook entries, so he drew upon all that. And he had also written so much and worked so hard that he had such a command of the language by then that he was able to just sit there and write that book at that speed. He was very proud of it at first. He took it and he went rushing off to Bob Giroux at Harcourt Brace, who had published Jack's first novel, which was a novel very influenced by Thomas Wolfe. And he rushed into Giroux's office and he said, "Here it is, the Holy Ghost wrote it." And he had the scroll with him and he went, "Whee!" And he threw the scroll across Giroux's office, you know, and he was expecting celebration. And instead of which, Giroux looked at the scroll with dismay and shock, and he said, "No editor could work from this. How would you couldn't give this to a printer? You know, what are you doing?" And Jack was furious and rolled up the scroll and said, "You have offended the Holy Ghost." You know, and out he walked. You know, he may indeed have felt that the Holy Ghost had written it because it had, you know, the book had seized him so tremendously. There's sometimes, you know, a lot of times writing is like as much fun as taking a pickaxe and going down to the coal mine, you know. But there are times when you're flying, when the words and the ideas, the flow seems to come from God knows where, you know, like the Holy Ghost wrote it. So he had that high for a little while, and then he was sort of shaken by his encounter with Giroux. And he had said the book had to be published as a scroll. You know, he would never retype it in a conventional way. But then, within a few weeks, he did indeed retype it, and as he retyped it on Benzedrine. As he retyped it, he began to revise it too. Because writers can never really leave their works alone. You know, it's just natural that, you know, he would revise it as he did that. And then when he resubmitted it to Giroux, who he really wanted to work with, Giroux read it and felt that, you know, it would be impossible to publish that book at that time, that being 1951. So Jack was crushed and disappointed. And I think he couldn't have helped but lost a little confidence, I think, in the book at that time. So he decided he's going to write On the Road again. So he gave that title to another book about Neal Cassady, which was eventually published as Visions of Cody, which is
How did this get published?
What?
How did this get published?
It was published after Jack's death. I had known that book was so important to him. He considered it his greatest writing, and no one had ever published it. I was working at McGraw-Hill as an editor then, so I decided that McGraw-Hill should publish it, and I got it out, which was great. And I didn't, you know, I didn't edit it. I didn't change anything. I sort of matched up some of the names that were inconsistent, but that's about all the work that I did on it. But then over the years, you know, 6 years passed, 1951 to 57, publishers kept turning it down, then Viking got it, and they, you know, Malcolm Cowley recognized that it was important because it was the voice of a generation, but he couldn't get the head of Viking to agree to publish it. It was, you know, it was too radical, too far out, full of people doing very unsavory things. Too new. Gertrude Stein once said, "Everything new is ugly." And in a way, that was true of On the Road. Well, it was a terribly discouraging time for Jack. At the same time, those 6 years were a remarkable creative period for him because he broke through into an even actually more strictly spontaneous form of writing, which he called sketching, where he was almost going out and writing down his impressions on the spot, almost like somebody would sketch a picture in the street. And Visions of Cody is not as accessible as On the Road, but it has some of the most remarkably beautiful prose in it, I think, that Jack ever wrote. Just spectacular writing. And then he wrote The Subterraneans, and he wrote Visions of Gerard. He just wrote a whole bunch of his books. I think he wrote six more books before 1957, when On the Road finally came out. And all during this time, too, they were very hard years. He was desperately broke. He was most of the time homeless. It sounds very romantic, going on the road, but the fact of the matter is he was living like a destitute, homeless person, terribly hard life. And he was, writing one novel after another, all in very short, concentrated periods of time. And, he must have been a tremendous, you can imagine the amount of energy that must have gone into those writing stints. And they were like sort of tremendous highs, but they would take everything out of him. And then he would crash afterwards. It would be like he'd be bored, he'd be depressed, he'd feel empty. By 1953, he was thinking he would never really write anything again. So that was the state he was in by the time On the Road finally came out. It was, to Jack, an old book. He had written it so many years ago, and he felt that the work that he had done since, which no one would even publish, not even Viking, which had published On the Road and had such a success with it, he felt those were his really great books. And, of course, over the years, he continued to revise On the Road, probably every time he had to retype it. And I think one thing that happened with On the Road is that there are passages that got much looser and the rhythms changed, the longer rhythms of the sentences. And also some of the later editions that Jack put in, I think, reflected his growing interest in Buddhism and his deepening sense of mortality. So I think all those additions were all to the good, but then all the editing that was imposed on the book, a lot of it was very destructive. So he had very mixed feelings about On the Road when it finally came out.
You mentioned the gap between 51 and 57.
Yeah.
You think about some of the things that happened in that period of time. What we saw that might have paved the way for Kerouac to be published, we had Brando in Streetcar Named Desire, James Dean appeared, Lolita came out, Alan Freed went on the airwaves, Playboy magazine came out. So it was an entirely different world into which the book was actually published. And even so, Kerouac was such a nostalgic figure, and so much of it seems to be rooted in the 30s and the 20s. But to talk about some of the things that were going on at the same time he was writing this, and I'll throw this over to David. At this period of time, John Cage was working with the treated piano, getting into the works of the piano and physically changing that, not just thinking about what you play on the piano. And Robert Rauschenberg and Jackson Pollock were playing with the physical characteristics of paint and the stuff that went onto the canvas and the way we put it there, mixing sand or nails inside the paint, or in the case of Rauschenberg, the combine paintings. Should we look at this the scroll innovation, getting down there and really taping together long rolls of tracing paper as a way to get at the kind of the material makeup that a work of art had?
Well, he had the idea that all of his books that he said eventually would be on the shelf as one gigantic kind of a history of the Dulois, meaning Kerouac, family, and all of his books together would be one whole colossal epic. And he said to me one time, he said, we're old men, someday we can move in the country with our families and lie around in hammocks and pick our teeth. and look at our children and grandchildren, and I'll look up on my bookshelves, see all those beautiful books. By that time, you'll have a bunch of symphonies you've written, and we can just sit there and tell our kids and grandkids what a wonderful time we had, and we'll still be working hard. He kind of had that dream that everything that he did was part of a whole enormous body of work, and that someday he would get redemption by having that appreciated by the world. And even in the last sad days when he was in Florida, I used to talk to him on the telephone. He always talked about what he was going to write and about coming back and resuscitating the jazz poetry readings that we'd done back in the 50s. And he wanted to do something with symphonies. He wanted to write a baseball opera. I wrote a cantata based on the Four Seasons of America from 50 books that he had recommended for me to choose from. He knew all 50 books and what was in them. He could quote Shakespeare, Beowulf, Racine, Baudelaire in French, old English poets by memory. He could sing the themes of Haydn's string quartets, and he was a tremendous scat singer and knew about jazz and appreciated country music and bluegrass and folk music. He loved all kinds of things. He appreciated Woody Guthrie's approach, that egalitarian, yay-saying, Whitman-esque approach towards life and towards traveling. And interestingly enough, in Europe, people considered Kerouac and Guthrie, who are completely different figures from totally different backgrounds, to be in the same spirit of embracing America from the bottom to the top and seeing the whole country in a very beautiful, elegiac kind of fashion. And when I was working on the symphony for Woody Guthrie, it took me 2 years because I had the same problem Jack did of how do you take something simple, everyday song like This Land Is Your Land, just where he would take a simple story of working with somebody picking with a migrant worker in that beautiful part of On the Road, and taking the simplest, ordinary thing and making something substantial out of it. And I think that he was, the relationship, especially with Rauschenberg, who, as you know, is a wonderfully schooled, formal painter who would go on the streets of New York and take what would be considered to be a piece of junk out of the sidewalk and build a whole painting around what society threw away, just the way Cézanne, when he was asked by his model after 200 sittings, Mr. Cézanne, why do you have that blank part of the canvas in the middle with no paint? And he said, that's what I base the whole painting on. That's kind of what Rauschenberg did. He would take a found object and he'd build a whole painting around what society thought was a piece of junk. Not because he was a nihilistic, trash-o-matic, avant-garde despiser of the European tradition of art, but because using that background, he found a way to do something to celebrate the everyday and the indigenous. That's what Jack did. And Jackson Pollock was expert in American Indian sand painting and studied with Benton and was tremendously schooled and saw the relationship of Native American art and the European tradition as a way to do something new. And, of course, Jackson Pollock was depicted even in that movie as just sort of a drunken moron that hurled paint cans against the canvases and got famous, but he was so much more than that. Just as they said that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie were playing wrong notes out of tune, and now, of course, they're studied in schools as brilliant, phenomenal improvisers whose work that was made up on the spot could stand the test of time by analyzing it. And just like Bach and Mozart, there's not one wrong note that you would want to change. And Jack tried to emulate that feeling of spontaneity. And when we had this wonderful panel in the New York Times where I was able to sit and listen to all of you, I told a very brief story, which I'll make even shorter tonight. I was invited by Jack to come over and visit him at midnight. And I was copying a piece of music mechanically, so I didn't have to do anything but try to have good penmanship. For 6.5 hours, he talked, and I looked out, and sure enough, the sun had come up. This incredible story he told me about being in the Middle East, and when he was visiting William Burroughs and speaking to French soldiers who would come with their Arabic friends at 1 o'clock in the morning and all sit and drink tea together, even they were supposed to be enemies, and as young men doing their military service, actually had a kind of a wonderful friendship. It was just an extraordinarily touching story. And I said, Jack, I wish I'd had a tape recorder. That would have been a book. And he said, that's what I try to do when I'm writing. I can never quite get it, but I want it to sound like I'm speaking to you. I wanted it to be natural. And he would sit and work so hard and take so many notes and listen and talk and look. And then when he finally wrote the book, I think like Mozart, he already had it in his head. No one accuses Mozart of being a speed musical typist. Mozart had that in his mind, and he wrote it out. And Jack had it in his mind, and I think in a certain sense, edited in his mind, And he always spoke about how he wanted to be like a saxophone player and just let it flow. But he had the sense of being able to make it sound natural and make it sound like he was speaking to you, because that's what he tried to do. And he tried to combine his natural storytelling ability when he was doing his formal work. And I think in the process, if you're writing music or painting or writing a play or doing anything, you're a better editor if you can live in that spontaneous world and be willing to fall on your face like a tightrope walker and get up again, but have a sensibility of what feels real, what feels natural, what feels your heart tells you what to do, and then sitting and slaving away and using the wastebasket and erasing it 11 times until it finally comes out right, so that the reader or the listener or the viewer will see something, just like when you're building a bottle in a boat inside of a bottle. You don't see the person with the tweezers and all the stuff spending 3 months killing themselves. You just see this beautiful boat inside the bottle and say, wow, I'd like to go sailing on that, but how did he ever do that? That's kind of what Jack's books are like. They're just such a joy to read. And as John mentioned and Joyce mentioned, some of his beautiful books, like the Dharma Bums, he wrote when he went back to that little dinky place in Orlando, which is now a writer's residence, and wrote that whole book after coming to New York and partying up a storm and suddenly becoming a world-famous figure. He went back to that humble place where he'd been before and finished another beautiful book. And he wrote The Vanity of Dulwaz in 1968 and was working on a novel called Pick when he died. So he was a real workaholic and an example of the work ethic, in spite of the tragedy of his drinking. And if I may mention, at that time, certainly none of us were aware that alcoholism is a disease that could be cured. We didn't know about 12-step programs, if there were any. And in our time, to be a real man, the more you could drink, the more moral and attractive person you were. If you could drink anybody under the table, you were terrific. And if you could smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day, you were great. And when you look at those old movies that John mentioned, of the Marlon Brando, James Dean movies, everybody's smoking up a few cigarettes and drinking up a storm. And that was considered to be not only socially acceptable, but desirable. And if you were some kind of an artist, you were supposed to be, by definition, an infantile, sociopathic, professional victim, which is a wonderful way to keep people's salaries down. And most of us went for that because that's what we were told, since we were called no-goodniks in the vernacular. That's what we were supposed to be. And as a result of that, Jack left us way too early. If he were here now, he'd be the head of a university somewhere. He'd be playing with a band. And he'd be hanging out with all of you tonight and sitting in with us playing the bongos, because he loved people and he loved life, and his books reflect that.
Well, we, of course, live in a different era where the postage stamp of Jackson Pollock has the cigarette removed from his mouth and the postage stamp of Robert Johnson. There's one photograph of Robert Johnson that exists, and he's got a cigarette, except on the postage stamp, and so he doesn't have a cigarette there.
Back in the 50s.
I loved what you said at the start of that, you know, Kerouac was always saying, you know, Dave, someday we'll be these old men. We'll be sitting around in our den with our feet up and all. You know, as much as Kerouac has been taken as an icon of rebel adolescence, he never romanticized youth. What he romanticized were the old guys. And what they're doing in On the Road, to a great extent, is looking for fathers and looking for them, sometimes in older guys, old hobos, old bums that they run into. That was really what his affection was for the older characters, that older America that he felt had been sort of pushed aside by middle-class, corporate, suburban 1950s America. So he was looking back, and he loved the old guys more than that freshness of youth, because there's wisdom in the ancient case. In Joyce's reading, there was a lot of beautiful stuff about the mountains and the rivers. And I think it's one of the nice things about On the Road, and Penny, I'll ask you to speak to this a little bit. It's in many ways a Valentine to the landscape of America, which people like of Kerouac's generation, the men of Kerouac's generation, had come back from Europe, from the war in Europe, to look at. And he had once called it the book of, Rain and Rivers. That was like one of the working titles of an early version of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so much about kind of reworking this map of America. A scholar that I work with, Ann Douglas, wrote in one piece a while back that when she first read this book, right after it came out, she realized that this was a nation that she had never seen before, you know, and it was peopled with all the people that usually don't hear about, the old people, the hobos, not the glamorous people. You know, these aren't the hipsters that we associate Kerouac with. It's the people who really were on the margins of society in a lot of ways, and these people for Kerouac had a lot to offer. African Americans, Native Americans, people that you didn't hear a whole lot about in the main books of that era. And, you know, when you read the book, you really get a sense of the ways in which it's this really expansive nation for Kerouac. I mean, you have a classic kind of east-west trajectory. It's this, like, frontier myth relived. But they get west, and they don't find what they're looking for, and they're just kind of bouncing back and forth. It's this really sad, in some ways, attempt to find America, and then they end up in Mexico, you know, which I think is not coincidental. They end up going down. I mean, they have to leave America to figure out basically what America is. And so, you know, it's a look at a different kind of America, I think. And Kerouac was really interested in redefining what we thought of as the nation. And he didn't, you know, he privileged the people who were the details, the filler, all the stuff that you're not really supposed to talk about or you're not supposed to write about. This is what made up the nation for him. And I think, again, you know, in the scroll version, you really get a sense of this, of the geography of the country. It's this really, it doesn't get broken up into these sections. It's this really, like, fast, exhilarating place. After he wrote this version, he told Neil, went fast because road is fast. So it's all about, you know, just the experiential aspect of rolling through America. What does that actually feel like, you know? And I feel like in the scroll version, you just get closer to that. It's exhilarating. It's sad. It's lonely. You get lost. You get frustrated. But it's more egalitarian. And I think this also goes along with the jazz improvisation spirit as well. You know, in jazz, there isn't one musician privileged over the others. You know, you have this collective whole. You have the solo, but you have the whole band together, you know, and you have the improvisation, and then it comes back. And so to me, it's all sort of part of the same thing. But I really see it as a really interesting way to think about America, both formally and thematically.
And, of course, among the characters he meets on the road, I think the most fascinating are the jazz musicians. And anytime there's I read the book as, among other things, a story about learning to write, and, in fact, learning to write the book that is on the road. And, you know, on his first trip out, he imagines himself coming into Denver, and he sees himself in his friend's eyes, and he says, you know, he imagines himself, them looking at him as the ragged prophet come in from the desert to deliver the dark word. And the only word I had was wow. So he can't really tell a story in the beginning of the book. And then by the end, after they've been to Mexico and Dean betrays him, and he's on his sick bed with dysentery, and Dean runs off to go marry his second wife, or third wife, so that he can leave her to go back to his second wife. Sal runs into this character that he called sometimes the great walking saint or the great mountain saint, who comes up to him and says, go moan for man. You know, in other words, go write this book. So he's, over the course of the book, he's learned to write. And really, the teachers along the way are partly Dean, but I think for the most part, they're the jazz musicians he meets, because they're teaching him how to express an idea that speaks not just himself, but everybody, how to tell everybody's life. I think he says, you know, how to fill the belly button strain of everybody's life. So, you know, Joyce, you know, you were with him in the jazz clubs. I think that the five spot was a part of your regular routine. But yet Kerouac didn't seem as close to the jazz musicians personally as some other of his friends were.
I think he'd been closer to them earlier, you know, in the days when he was, when he was going to Horace Mann Prep School in Columbia and hanging around Birdland, and the scene had changed. There was a wonderful bar called the Five Spot on Fifth Street in the Bowery, and everybody went there, poets, writers, painters, dancers, actors. You could go in, you could have a 25-cent beer and hear John Coltrane. It was fabulous. One night I heard Billie Holiday there. They had taken away her cabaret license, and she just stood up at a table and sang. It was, incredible things happened at the Five Spot. And Jack, as David said, he really loved music, but his ear was so musical. His prose is full of, so much rhythm and cadence and all those impalpable things about language that, that make it rich and evocative. It's not just the content. It's all that sound, all that other stuff that's so important. And he just had a fantastic sense of it. And with all those sounds, you got also all the modulations in mood, that's why the prose seems so alive. It isn't just like one monolithic state of mind. It's constantly shifting and moving. It's almost like an extension of what the modernists like Virginia Woolf and James Joyce were trying to do with stream of consciousness.
And he at one time called it On the Road, a modern novel in the sense of modern jazz.
Yeah.
And I love that you mentioned he wrote about, his Horace Mann days. I love the idea that he interviewed Count Basie for his high school paper. Just the idea of making that call. This has been great. I hope there's some questions out in the audience, and we can get you microphones. We've got the power. If you raise your hand, a microphone will come to you.
I was curious to know if any of you had ever gotten in a junker and headed across the United States, or just to try to sort of figure out what On the Road might have felt like if you were doing it.
Well, I wanted to, but it was the early 1950s, and I was a girl, and I was cautious. Although I was in love with Jack Kerouac, I planned to meet him in San Francisco and then in Mexico City, but he always left those places before I could pack up in New York and get there. But I was ready. My bags were packed. I always wonder, what that experience in Mexico City might have been like. I mean, it might have been great. It might have been a total disaster. What do you think, David?
Well, it would have been great for Jack.
David lives on the road, by the way, so he can probably talk about that.
Well, it's different because when I'm driving to Lowell tomorrow, and I drive all over the country and travel and go on planes, but I have a grounding of always writing a piece of music, and I'm lucky enough, as I turn 77, for some reason to still be healthy, and I have three incredible children, aside from Adam, two wonderful daughters, and that is the greatest 12-step program for anyone. You have your first child, and you see that beautiful person. You say, well, you're going to have to give up something. So when they get a little older, you can be around. That's the blessing. Jack did have a daughter, but he was estranged from her and never knew really whether it was his daughter or not until the very end, which was tragic for both of them. But he always spoke of wanting to have a family and always talked about that and had tremendously old-fashioned ideals. And for him, traveling and being on the road was a certain kind of a search. And when you have that philosophy of the being on that trail of beauty, which is why I named that piece for the Philly Orchestra years ago, Trail of Beauty, it was the Navajo prayer of the 12th night we used to talk about, where beauty before us, beauty around us, beauty below us, beauty above us, on the trail of beauty, therefore I am. That's kind of the English translation. That was the Navajo prayer of the 12th night, the idea being that every moment is precious, that everything is beautiful. So wherever you go, there's something to learn, something to share, something to appreciate, and something to be thankful for. So in that sense, being on the road in that way is a wonderful thing. Part of the beauty of the book was that Neil himself, who is an extraordinary person, And we have to remember the post-euphoria of World War II when Jack made that first trip in 1947. That was 2 years after World War II was over. As John mentioned in his book and tonight, it was a whole different America from the America, as you mentioned, of James Dean and Marlon Brando and John Cage and everyone in 1957 when the book finally came out. Being on the road at that time, hitchhiking was the natural thing that we all did. There was gas rationing in World War II. Everyone hitchhiked. You always would pick up a serviceman. I was in the same place as Jack was in 1947, 48, where they just played my symphony last Sunday. I was there and hitchhiked all the way out in 48 to San Jose. And you could hitchhike. You could go out. People would pick you up. There was almost like a sociable thing to do. Hitchhiking was an art in itself. And Jack and Neil being on the road and those wonderful descriptions, they were looking for something, and it was almost that it was a certain spiritual quest. And you have to remember that he was a very devout church-going Catholic and also a devout Buddhist in his own style of modern Buddhism, which I surmise from hanging out with him all the time. He felt it was the most Christ-like way to behave in a modern society by adopting some of Buddhism. But he was essentially a Catholic emotionally, went to church, and caught a lot of flack because he would go to these fancy Eastern Seaboard literary establishment parties with a huge cross on, and really it was almost like he was wearing a swastika. I said, Jack, being Jewish and being brought up in America and everything, I knew that people hated black people and Jewish people. I didn't know they hated Catholics. He said, well, some places people think that that's déclassé and ethnic and trashy, especially when you get into the New York Eastern Seaboard establishment. I'm speaking of 50 years ago. Now I don't think there is an Eastern Seaboard establishment. The whole world is opened up with the Internet and the World Wide Web. The information highway is so big that no one can snob anybody to death anymore. But at that time, 50 years ago, you were kind of stuck. And when Jack suddenly got off the road and would go to these literary parties and start hanging out with anybody and everybody, usually purposefully finding the most insecure person in the room and hanging out with them on purpose, because that's the way he was, almost like the St. Francis philosophy. People thought he was a traitor to his newfound class. And he was devastated because he wanted to be friendly and open with everybody. And he thought that was the way that you should be.
Actually, I just want to say one thing. It's an interesting question. I teach at Columbia and at NYU, and I sometimes teach Kerouac. And this idea of going on the road, I think it's still really powerful for people. I'm not sure that it's the same thing. I mean, I don't think there's this feeling that you're going to go and, like, go over uncharted territory anymore. But I feel like young people still have this urge in America to go out. Maybe it's backpacking around Europe these days. The last time I did that, I was panhandling in Italy. That's another story. Trying to get to Greece because I lost all my money. But I do think, as much as the book is not about the success of the road at all, I mean, it's not about freedom and finding, I mean, it's about hoping to find freedom and about, I think, failing to find it and being really sad and lost, and it's about death, and it's about all these other things. I still think that idea of the road is really powerful in our cultural consciousness. I don't know what other people
think. I think the road is also about something else. It's also about being in a state of suspension. You're between here or there. And here or there, you might have to make some very difficult life decisions. But on the road, you're in suspension. You're living in the moment. You have all these passing encounters that, you know, that are intense, but not crucial. I mean, Jack was a man who could never figure out how he wanted to live. He was always being torn apart in two different ways. Yeah, he did have fantasies about, maybe he'd have a family. That's what he should do. But there was also a part of him who couldn't stand the thought of being tied down, having a family. You know, that not being able to go and anywhere he wanted, do anything he wanted to do. So he couldn't resolve those polarities. So, you know, he was always, you know, maybe most content, except when he was writing, of course. But, you know, when he was moving, when he was a state of in between, when he first thought of on the road, you know, in 1947, he said it was about two boys who went out to California where there is nothing and come back. And that was always the case with Jack. He would always imagine the destination that he was going to. When he was with me, he was going to Tangier, you know, and he had all these wonderful images of how Tangier was going to be and the music and the walking through the marketplace and so on. When he got there, he hated it. He wrote to me, you know, the vibe's very bad here. Arabs send out no vibrations at all, you know. Not even the whores speak English, you know. It wasn't what he imagined, and that was always happening to him. That was a terrible, terribly sad thing about Jack.
It's a great question. In the corner there.
Could you give me sort of a historical perspective here? I saw Allen Ginsberg several years ago at University of Pennsylvania, and he showed some of the movies, and he suggested that in 1947 he met up with Jack Kerouac, and I sort of got the impression that this went into the 50s, the Beat Generation, and went into the hippies, sort of restless air, where people went to California in 1967. Could I get a historical perspective on that with the beatniks, the hippies, and Allen Ginsberg?
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.